So this is another episode of Better, Worse, or the Same. And today on the show, we have Jacob Stengenga. I hope I said it right. I'm so sorry.
That's great.
How would you describe yourself? What credentials would you say you have?
Okay, well, so I have a PhD in philosophy of science. So I'm a professor of philosophy and specifically philosophy of science. But my academic background is actually pretty eclectic. So my first degree was in the sciences, and then I did a master's degree in physiology. And then I started studying more philosophy of science.
Sure. Now what, I want to kind of jump into the main crux of the talk, but really quickly, what motivated the philosophy of science? And for some of the listeners, could you explain exactly what a philosophy of science degree entails? Not so much entails, but what you do with that?
Sure. Yeah. So first, I can just say a couple of words about what philosophy of science is. So philosophy of science focuses on concepts in science that are important to science, but aren't strictly empirical. So you can't just use scientific methods to study them. So that can include core concepts like time, genes, space, causation. That can also include methods. So for example, if you want to test if some drug does blah, 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 there's a question about what the best method is to test that. So we're interested in conceptual questions, methodological questions in science and medicine. And so people who get a PhD in philosophy tend to have an academic career in mind. That's the path that I went down. But some people who get a philosophy degree, especially an undergraduate degree, they go on to study law or study medicine.
Sure. So
all sorts of paths that people can take with a training in philosophy.
Sure. So I was first introduced to some of your work, a piece you wrote called Gentle Medicine. And this was in, I believe it was in May of 2020, right when COVID was starting. And in that piece, I found it so fascinating that you kind of argued against using aggressive interventions in medicine. And you gave a number of examples why this wasn't a good idea. What motivated you to get into the medicine specifically and focus on the effectiveness of medicine?
Yeah. Okay. So let's see. There's a few things in that question. So during my studies, I guess I was exposed to a few puzzles in medical research that medical researchers themselves were having a hard time sorting out. And as a budding philosopher, that interested me because, you know, from a naive view from the outside is that medicine has some of its kind of, you know, core business already.
Sure. Started. Yeah.
So just to give you one kind of concrete example of that, I was working in a public health agency in Canada, and this was 25 years ago. And back then there was a big question about what kind of masks to provide healthcare workers during a pandemic. sounds familiar,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
And so there's a big debate like, well, should it be N95 masks? Should it be, you know, cloth masks? And there was all this evidence, but the evidence was kind of discordant. You couldn't really like make sense of what the best line of evidence was. So some of the pro-mask people would point to case control studies or animal studies or computer simulations. And some of the kind of mask doubters would point to randomized control trials and show they make the argument that, you know, when you test masks under these careful RCT settings, they don't help all that much.
Sure.
So it's a debate that, you know, sounds very familiar in the kind of COVID pandemic era. So I was interested in that kind of question. I was interested in that problem. Like, we've got this really important causal hypothesis, masks will decrease the spread of a respiratory virus. And there's all these different kinds of evidence for it, computer simulations, animal studies, RCTs, and so on. So how to make sense of that all? And that was a problem that the scientists themselves were grappling with. And I thought, well, maybe philosophy has got something to say there. So that was a kind of intellectual motivation to get into it.
Sure.
Personal motivation. So some people that were very close to me in life, people that I cared about a lot, suffered from various kinds of medical ailments. And it seemed to me that medicine was largely letting them down. So, you know, people with long-term chronic conditions, psychiatric conditions, and I just frankly didn't see medicine helping all that much. So there was, you know, kind of intellectual motivations and personal motivations for me to turn the tools of philosophy of science to medicine. And of course, one of the big questions that I was interested in was just how effective are modern medicines really?
Sure. No, absolutely.
Yeah. And so then another thing, I kind of started dabbling in some literature that was written by physicians themselves or by epidemiologists, some very big named physicians, like, you know, people who had been chief editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, for example. And there's, you know, maybe about a dozen books that were very critical of medicine. These are big name doctors and epidemiologists who were saying things like, yeah, I just don't trust anything that's published in any medical journal anymore. That kind of shocked me at the time. And so I was interested in trying to sort out what their reasons were.
Sure. So what I find is so interesting is that I remember reading a couple books. Overtreated is one that I remember. And this was written before COVID, and it kind of outlined a lot of the pitfalls that medicine will fall into, right? And a lot of this research was before COVID. You know, mask studies showed, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, you did your Canada mask experiment, but mask studies showed that masks weren't as good as we thought they were. And what's interesting is that we have all this data before COVID. COVID hits, and then we kind of go absolutely insane, and we're actually using very bad science. And I guess my question is where does that come from? Do you think that science, do you think that medicine is directing people's mindset, or do you think that people are inherently attuned to having a quote unquote expert kind of tell them what to do, and medicine can fill that gap rather quickly?
Yeah, I guess all of those things are happening and did happen during the COVID pandemic. I think a good example of this kind of science going astray is in the early days of COVID, this hunt for pharmaceutical treatments for COVID. Now, if you kind of rewind the clock and you look at the track record of medicine developing pharmaceutical treatments for respiratory viruses, the track record is really dim. Medicine is great at a few things. Medicine Sure. is great at, you know, bacterial infections, type 1 diabetes. You know, there's some very simple diseases that medicine can treat really well, but respiratory viruses isn't really one of them. And so in the early days of COVID, there was this hunt all around the world by many different research groups to test pharmaceutical treatments for COVID. There was a website that was tracking the number of RCTs that were being performed on various interventions for COVID. And mm-hmm. it was into the thousands. And by the end of 2020, there was something like 4,000 RCTs being done on pharmaceutical treatments for COVID. And many of these trials were small. They were poorly controlled. They were, you know, spread out all over the world. Some of them were very big and very well done. But it struck me at the time, and it still impresses me, that there's this huge amount of resources devoted to this hunt for pharmaceutical treatments for COVID when we should have had a prior expectation that
it's just not going to work.
Yeah, or if it does work, the effect sizes are going to be really, really small. On the other hand, it's plausible that things like physical distancing or social distancing would help mitigate the spread of a respiratory virus. And so, and I mean, as a matter of fact, many governments obviously implemented policies like that, but they implemented such policies in the absence of much compelling evidence that these policies did sure. in fact work very well. So what I would have liked to have seen is less RCTs on pharmaceutical interventions and more RCTs on things like school closings or border closings or physical distancing or masking and so on.
So, and we have this post-COVID world now. I mean, I would hope that we could think of it as a little bit of a post, you know, a recovery in a sense. And it seems that some of these RCTs that you're talking about came to conclusions that said, you know, Paxlovid is a great med, we should all use it. And if you dig into the data a little bit more, it's actually a very limited medication. It doesn't really work in most settings. What Is it just that people's minds, that we have a question and medicine can answer it in a very compelling way, or big pharma can answer it in a compelling way, and then we just stop asking that question? It seems that people are just, once they get an answer they like, they just shut down, and further thought is just stopped at that point.
Yeah. So two COVID examples come to mind that illustrate this for me. So one is dexamethasone. You know, this big trial. This was one of the best trials that was done on pharmaceutical treatments for COVID. And that the one positive signal they got in this trial was dexamethasone. And so everybody celebrated this as like a big, big breakthrough treatment for COVID. But when you actually look at the data, actually it was an extremely limited tool. So, you know, dexamethasone only helped people who were on respirators in ICUs. It didn't have a positive impact on people that were outside of that setting. So that's already a very limited, you know, target. So, you know, it's a kind of a situation in which the benefits were really exaggerated. And then I think another example of this is comes from the Bangladesh mask study. So there was this huge trial. Do you know about the Bangladesh mask study?
This is, I was inundated with studies. After a while, I'll be honest, I just stopped reading.
Okay. Yeah. Well, but it's a very compelling example. So what they did was they took 600 villages in Bangladesh and randomly allocated them to either a mask group or a control group. So the mask group, they got free masks. They got training on how to wear the masks. They got information about the importance of wearing masks and so on. And the control group didn't get any of that. And over 6 months, they counted the number of positive COVID cases in these villages. Now, in these villages, there was something like 350,000 people living there, so randomly allocated to these two groups. And the number of cases of COVID, so there was something like 1,106 in the control group and 1,086 in the mass group. So it was a difference of 20.
Sure.
Over 350,000 people randomized. Now, so that sounds really small, but when they published the paper, and I think this was in maybe the New England Journal, I forget where they published it, they reported a relative risk reduction. That relative risk reduction was around 9.5%. Now, that's kind of a technical thing, but
sure.
reporting relative risk reductions is very, very misleading. What they should have done was report absolute risk reduction, which was way less than 0.1%. They then wrote an editorial in the New York Times saying, we did the research, masks work. So, you know, they promoted this finding that masks work, which in some strict sense was true. But as a matter of fact, the effect size they got was way
minimal,
0.1%. Yeah.
So what is it that motivates this? I mean, I'm cynical, and I have the idea that it's mostly financial, right? Or I should say capital in the form of both social capital. As a medical provider, there's a lot of social capital. And then there's also the financial side as well. But what do you think do you think it's that sinister, or do you think there's something else that's motivating these researchers?
Yeah, I think in some contexts of medicine, I would stick my neck out and say the motivations for skewing the available evidence and interpreting it in a particular way is probably sinister. I think there's a lot of things going on. So when it comes to, for example, drug treatment for diseases, patients want to hope. They want to hope for mm-hmm. something better. So when you're ill, there's this like great longing, or if you have a family member who's ill, there's this great longing that there'll be some intervention that can help. And so you're kind of willing to believe or willing to accept. On the financial side, you know, something like 80% of research resources in medicine are controlled by private industry, and private industry has a vested, you know, interest in
sure.
their interventions to look safe and effective, even if they're not. So, and then professional physicians, you know, they're trained to intervene. That, you know, you get this long, rigorous education, and it's all about getting trained to intervene. And so, you know, there's the mentality of the patients who hope for some intervention. Mm-hmm. There's the training of the physicians, which is all kind of intervention oriented. There's the available evidence, which is systematically skewed to exaggerating the benefits and underestimating the harms of interventions. And then I think there are broader kind of social things too. So one thing that we saw especially acute during the COVID pandemic was this kind of politicization of science and medicine. So, you know, if you were like a left-leaning voter, then you were, you know, going with the science. And if you were like a Trump voter, then you were sort of, you know, anti-mask, maybe anti-vaccine and so on. And so I think there was this, you know, if you're walking in particular circles, then it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. It's an echo chamber.
Yeah. You get an echo chamber on both sides of the political spectrum. So I think that the kind of excessive trust in science and medicine gets off the ground for all the reasons we were just speaking about, the financial stuff, the patient hoping stuff, but I think also for this on political grounds too.
And what's so interesting about that is you mentioned the pro-science camp, and then you had a camp that said this is all a conspiracy. But by and large, it was very interesting because the pro-science camp was using a lot of emotion, and the anti-science camp, in my mind, happened to come to the right conclusions by happenstance. Right. They just came. It's like, well, you were lucky this time. But it was very interesting because there wasn't logic flew out the window and the politicization of it. And I would argue that in a lot of medicine, there's a lot more of this political mindset of medicine has its own political dogma in a sense. And unfortunately, it's very self-promoting and people buy into that.
Many dogmas, yeah. So I think another example of this in the COVID era was the so-called lab leak hypothesis. Right? So did COVID come out of a lab in China, or was it a result of some, you know, animal to human contact? There was, you know, about a year to 2 years where it was scientifically unpopular to promote the lab leak hypothesis. I mean, if you were promoting the lab leak hypothesis, then, you know, you're suspiciously xenophobic, suspiciously anti-China, suspiciously favorable towards, you know, Trump style politics.
Yeah, QAnon type of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was conspiratorial, but then that pivoted rapidly. And it's hard not to shake the hunch that the pivot. So now it's a live open question. That scientists are willing to entertain the thought that COVID leaked from the Wuhan lab. And where did that pivot come from? It's hard not to shake the hunch that that pivot came from just changes in kind of global geopolitics. The dogma shifted quickly on that one.
So if you look at the history of medicine and you look at as some medical folks would call the pre-scientific era. So before the 1880s, 1890s, before we had the germ theory from the, I think it was 1860s, medicine was closely linked with religion. And people, you know, medical providers were kind of this in between the divine and the mortal realm, right? And they would use prayers or whatever it may be. And nowadays, it seems that we got rid of that. But in a sense, it almost seems that we're no better off if you look at medicine as a whole. Do you think that maybe we're searching for this greater question and modern? And if we have such a secular view of medicine, it's very difficult. And so we tend to believe in things that don't necessarily... We tend to believe in things that we want. It's more medicine based on faith rather than medicine based on logic. I know that was a little big. That was a lot there. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's an interesting thought. I mean, I do think that a lot of the confidence that we place in medicine is a result of this all too human tendency to hope and believe in things. Some people believe in, you know, religious ideas.
Sure.
Some people, you know, put a lot of their belief in medicine as a domain in which our health can be improved. I think it's interesting to think back through the history of medicine. So there were these very prominent physicians in the 18th and 19th century that would say things like, we should just get rid of all of our current drugs. They're not helping patients at all. Or they would say things like, and these are like, you know, the dean of the Harvard Medical School would say things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, what physicians do best is just kind of like, you know, like giving patients a bit of care while the disease heals itself.
Yeah.
So this was a kind of common view, yeah, until about the end of the 19th century. And then there was a kind of breakthrough. I like to think of this as the kind of the golden age of medicine, right? So starting around 1890 and going through to about 1950, there were all these amazing breakthroughs in medicine, antibiotics, the development of vaccines, some very basic diseases. You know, we figured out how to treat them, like, you know, scurvy. And so this golden age of medicine gave us this notion that I call the magic bullet. So we like penicillin for bacterial infection.
Sure.
And so that we've kind of inherited that idea. And now broadly in society, people think that there's going to be magic bullets for all sorts of diseases. And that the very idea of magic bullet is used in advertising, in medical education. And it's extremely misleading because we have, you know, magic bullets for just a very small handful of diseases.
And I like, you mentioned this a little bit in some of your writings. I hope I pronounce it properly, but the McKeon thesis and the McKeon findings where a lot, and I fell into this trap where I believed that population increases occurred because of modern medicine. And actually, if you look at the data, the mortality of a lot of diseases was decreasing before the development of antibiotics.
Yeah.
I think it's just crazy to think that a lot of these fundamental concepts have been completely lost for whatever reason. And medicine is sold as like a completely separate thing from the reality of the situation.
Yeah. So I also don't know how to pronounce this name.
I think it's McKeon. I believe
McKeon or McKeon, yeah, McKeown, something like that. Yeah, so the basic idea here is this is like he was a physician who was also a kind of historian of medicine and epidemiologist. And so his argument was that the increase in lifespan that we've observed since the Industrial Revolution is a result of social things. And basically his argument is broader access to protein. So nutritional changes led to this increase in lifespan. Some of his critics have said things like, okay, McKeon, you're forgetting about sanitation and hygiene and so on. But even if we accept that, so even if we supplement the McKeon thesis with hygiene and sanitation and so mm-hmm. on, still not drugs, right? It's not
modern medicine.
Not modern medicine, yeah. And that, I mean, he's got a mountain of data that supports that thesis. It's a bit ironic. So sometimes when I've been presenting my work, so I've got this book, Medical Nihilism, and it was published a few years ago. So I kind of stopped giving lectures on it recently. But when I was giving lectures on it, I had this interesting line of feedback that I would get from people. And I got this from kind of arch evidence-based medicine people, which is ironic for a reason I'll explain. They would say, look, there's got to be a problem with your argument here, this argument that we should have little trust in modern medicine, because look at the increase in lifespan that we've had. There's this, you know, great increase in lifespan, and that's got to be due to modern medicine.
Sure.
So that's, I mean, clearly it's violating this McKeon thesis we were just speaking about, but it's also ironic coming from so-called evidence-based medicine people, because what the core tenet of evidence-based medicine is that you should test a hypothesis with a randomized control trial, because if you don't, there's all these possible confounding factors that could be the real cause of whatever evidence you get. And so if you make this historical argument that, well, there's been all these developments in medicine and our lifespan has gotten better at the same time, that's just a correlation, right? So you get these people that are suspicious of correlations making this kind of grand correlation argument, which I think is not at all compelling.
So you mentioned a little bit evidence-based medicine. Do you find that evidence-based medicine and the ideas behind it could lead to better medicine? Or do you think that evidence-based medicine falls into the same traps?
Yeah, so a lot of people like to beat up on evidence-based medicine. And I think that it has the tools to help improve medicine if they were properly implemented.
Sure.
Supplemented with a bit more than what's on offer. So a lot of people are suspicious of randomized controlled trials. My own view is that they're really important methodological tools to test any kind of medical intervention.
What would be some of the critiques of a randomized controlled trial?
Yeah, so there's many. So there's kind of there's very fundamental critique. So some mm-hmm. people say, look, there's a potentially infinite number of confounding factors, and when you only randomize once, there's still a very high probability that confounds are going to be imbalanced between your intervention group and your control group. That's a kind of foundational challenge. Mm-hmm. There's challenges about the kinds of inferences that we draw from randomized control trials. So it's a very common inference to say, you get some effect size X in a trial, therefore X is going to be the effect size you see in the broader population or when you're treating this particular patient. And both of those inferences are fallacious. So going from the kind of confined settings of an RCT to using this intervention in the wild, you're very likely to get different effect sizes, and I would say typically lower effect sizes. So those are the kinds of concerns that some people raised about RCT. And then there's very practical concerns. So like,
sure.
Stuff we were speaking about earlier, like pharmaceutical companies controlling RCTs, so the RCT gets biased in various ways.
Skewed.
Or you're only going to find harmful side effects of a drug if you go looking for them. And many, many RCTs don't look for a broad range of harms of drugs. And for obvious reasons, the designers of the trials don't want to discover them.
Sure.
So there's a bunch of criticisms of RCTs, but the question is, how else can we test interventions? So I think most interventions ought to be held to the standard of evaluation by RCT. It's just that those RCTs should be like properly done. My view is that they should be controlled and implemented by organizations that don't have an immediate financial conflict of interest in the outcome of the RCT. Somehow medical research should be organized such that glaring conflict of interest is
sure
managed. And then other kinds of evidence, I think, should inform our inferences about interventions. So it shouldn't just be like, we did an RCT on this intervention, it gave us this outcome X, and now we're just going to believe X. Instead, we should be informing that inference about the intervention with like background theory, mechanistic knowledge, and so on. Yeah. So it's not that RCTs are all bad. It's just that they're
utilized improperly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So kind of a new idea coming out recently is artificial intelligence and ChatGPT and the way that we can use these large computer learning models to solve problems. Would it be possible that we could somehow build a computer model where medicine is now delivered in a different manner and we take this irrational human component out of it? Or do you think that we'll fall into the same problematic behaviors using this new tool?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I certainly think some aspects of medicine could be at least supplemented using AI kinds of tools. I mean, as you know, lots of clinical practice is already kind of vending machine-like, right?
Oh, yeah.
So a patient comes in, they've got a particular pattern of symptoms. It's very straightforward to diagnose and very straightforward to prescribe. I mean, just like take a simple example, like ringworm. I mean, there's like absolutely no ambiguity. If a patient comes in, they've got ringworm, you just tell them to go to the pharmacy and get clotrimazole or whatever. That could all be done by a vending machine. A smart vending machine, a vending machine that's, informed by some kind of technology like AI.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it might be possible, but it might be possible, and it already is, that we're already building systems to do this. But it does beg the question, almost like taking the pilot out of an airplane in certain situations, are we better off?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I certainly don't think that AI will be able to replace trained physicians. And this gets back to something that we were speaking about sort of at the start of our conversation. So I guess my own view about a lot of the benefits of medicine are that it's a caring modality. Patients want to be cared for. We know that the placebo effect is extremely strong, at least for some diseases, it's extremely strong. And so we want to be able to utilize those features of medicine, hope of patients, the importance of placebo, and so on. And that's got to be done in a kind of caring setting.
In a humanistic manner.
Yeah, yeah. So no kind of AI.
No, but it would, and I agree with you that I think that for some of the big questions in life, we have rituals and we have cultural practices to help us understand these questions that maybe we can't answer at that time. And I agree that medicine has an important role, but I mean, I would almost argue that you could achieve that role with a non-physician. And I know the physicians would be up in arms about this, but imagine I'm imagining a medical training where you have someone who's trained in, you know, more in psychology and human development and less in these sciences, because it seems to me that these sciences, while very important, are not being utilized in the proper way to achieve that better outcome.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I think I see where you're coming from here. I like the idea of rituals. So, I guess, yeah, when I was younger, I was more suspicious of kind of social mores and rituals.
Sure.
And I've come to appreciate them more. Like take the example of, you know, a wedding. I mean, strictly speaking, a couple doesn't have to go through a wedding, right? To promise each other a future together. But that social ritual does have a really important function. And so I think that you could say the same thing about a patient coming to a physician. There is a kind of ritual. It's important for some people. And so then your idea was that that ritual could be performed by people with not necessarily the kind of medical education that physicians tend to get. And I agree with that. And I think part of what you're saying was the education that physicians tend to get might in fact be harming that ritual. And I think there's some real truth to that. So this is an example that I use in a lot of my work is depression. So for a long time, there was this theory of depression that it was caused by an imbalance of some kind of monoamine, right? Like a serotonin depletion theory of depression. And that in part motivated the development of the, you know, serotonin modes of treatment, SSRIs. And these days, most people who work on the topic are suspicious of this theory. So this kind of, it's not an anti-scientific theory, but the kind of adherence to it is sort of excessively sort of pseudo-scientific, if you will. And it's motivated the use of this treatment modality, which some people think doesn't do any good.
Mm-hmm.
So but the use of that treatment modality is motivated on this kind of semi-scientific ground or pseudo-scientific ground, namely this, you know, adherence to this monoamine theory. And so I think had medicine as a discipline a different kind of professional training, different kind of education and expertise, they might be able to deal with a disease like depression better than just giving pills.
Sure. Yeah. And the thing that you mentioned is we have this idea that takes hold and then we move on from that. And it's very interesting because a lot of the things in medicine, certain treatments, certain disease processes, we come to this conclusion of the science is settled in a sense. And then generations of medical providers are taught on the quote unquote settled science only to find out that it's not very scientific and it's very shaky. And the problem is that I feel like we've almost lost the idea of what science is, it's such a fungible topic that we can make it whatever we want depending on our motivation.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's exactly right. So in medicine, okay, here's what I'd say in response though. So there is such a thing I think is kind of going too far on the other side. So it's become sort of fashionable to say things like, all science is provisional, right? We used to have this naive view about science, that science would get us certainty, science would get us all the truths and so on. But now, you know, there's this kind of pushback against that, which is to say all science is provisional. So I think somewhere in the middle here is the right view. So if we take, you know, medical theories, for example, I wouldn't say that like our understanding of type 1 diabetes is going to go through
a kind of
big revolution. Yeah, yeah.
Sure. So
like the beta cells of the pancreas don't produce enough endogenous insulin, so we give some exogenous insulin, and you know we can manage
fix the problem.
Yeah. So that's not provisional, right? But there are lots of scientific theories, both in this kind of cutting edge of physics, but also in medicine, particularly in the domains that are really complicated, like the mind. So there, our theories are extremely provisional. Our evidence for any particular theory is underdetermines the of the theory.
Yeah. But one thing that I would add to that is that it seems that if there is a treatment based on a questionable scientific finding, but there's money to be made in there, it seems that there's a lot of effort to solidify that disease model into the scientific pantheon, you know, the scientific book of knowledge, so that we can sell that treatment, right? It's almost very disheartening to see this process and the way that it's influenced by outside actors.
Yeah, this is a huge problem in medicine. So so most Western countries have intellectual property laws that protect medical innovations under patent. And so if you're a company and you own the intellectual property to a new pharmaceutical, then you're that's typically protected for about 20 years. And the thing is, developing and selling pharmaceuticals, it's a little bit like developing and selling music. Mm-hmm. So you get the intellectual property over a piece of music, and then distributing it is extremely cheap. So there's this huge profit to be had by selling music, because you know, once you've got that digital file, all you need to do is, you know, sell it on a CD or on Spotify or whatever. And so that's very cheap to produce. Pharmaceuticals are like this. So once you've got the pharmaceutical under patent, then it's typically not very expensive to produce, but you can sell it for huge gains. And so that explains why the pharmaceutical industry is year after year one of the most profitable industries that we have. And that financial incentive corrupts all sorts of things in medicine. So, and one that we were speaking about earlier is the reliability of the evidence for the effectiveness of interventions.
So you hear this a little bit you hear this a lot in the United States, where if we took away if we didn't charge as much for pharmaceuticals, there wouldn't be the incentive to develop them. And I think a lot of people would push back and say, if we didn't have these intellectual property laws, why would we develop these drugs? What would you say to that if someone came to you and said, you know, there's a flip side here?
Yeah, yeah. So the most common argument for intellectual property protection in general, not just in medicine, is that it incentivizes research and development of important products for us. Now, one thing that's interesting about that argument is that it's strictly speaking an empirical argument, right? It's not like an a priori deductive argument. It's not like 2 + 2 = 4. It's a claim about the world. And so it may be true or it may be false. Mm-hmm. I think arguably in most domains of life, there's something true about it. We have these, you know, amazing phones, and in part the reason why we have these amazing phones, or the ability for us to have this conversation, you know, from around the world, is because companies have been incentivized to create these wonderful products. So the question is that true in medicine? And there, it's not so obvious to me. So in science in general, and in medicine in particular, we have this long history of developments that were not motivated by any kind of intellectual property protection. So we've got, like, you know, very basic scientific breakthroughs like the double helix structure of DNA. We've got pharmaceutical treatments like the very first antibiotics or the very first vaccines. So these like extremely important breakthroughs were not developed in the context of companies or individual scientists seeking intellectual property protection, then selling their products under patent. On the flip side, it looks like that this current system, this kind of profit incentive in the context of research and development in medicine, does incentivize companies to get their products to look safe and effective, regardless of whether or not they are safe and effective. So we end up with this kind of evidence base, which is unreliable because of that financial incentive. And there's other considerations that critics raise. So this so-called Me Too drugs. So Me Too drug is like the latest installment in a family of drugs for which there's already a bunch.
Right? Sure.
So like
statins depression drugs.
The 11th SSRI. Yeah. So it's called Me Too drugs because some company over here sees that company over there making billions of dollars with some drug. I want one too. And so they develop. So is that good for patients? I mean, now this is kind of controversial. So some people say, look, that's not very helpful for patients. So you don't need like 20 different pharmaceuticals to treat one particular disease, right? Like 3 or 4 is enough. What some people say in response is, well, yeah, but you know, some patients aren't responding. So like this particular patient doesn't respond so well to this particular kind of drug, but having another in that family of drugs is helpful because they might be a responder to that one. I think that that's compelling in some circumstances, but I think that that kind of argument is overblown. So this problem of Me Too drugs means that we're chasing all of these drugs that get patent protection, but aren't actually contributions to the, you know, toolkit that medicine has.
No. And I would argue that with a lot of those Me Too drugs, I think the effect with a lot of folks is a placebo effect, right? They like the packaging. They like the name. It's the same chemical structure. It's, you know, it's like a Pepsi versus Coke argument. And in reality, it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that pattern of kind of clinical reasoning that I was just kind of walking through, I think a lot of that is about placebo. So, and also confirmation bias. So, in fact, I'm doing some research right now with a PhD student in which we're developing a kind of a computer simulation to test out this very pattern of reasoning. So the basic idea is, so you're a physician, Mary comes to you with some symptoms, you diagnose Mary of having this particular disease, and you give Mary drug one, maybe there's 10 to choose from. She goes away, she comes back, she hasn't gotten much better. So you try drug two. She goes away, comes back, doesn't get much better. Maybe you change the dosing on drug two, or maybe you give drug three. She goes away, comes back, and looks like she's improved. And so the question is, you might say to yourself, oh, okay, so drug three
is a way to go.
Yeah, it's a way to go. Or you might say, oh, so Mary's not a drug one responder or a drug two responder, but Mary is a drug three responder. And Mary herself, like, she tried drug one, didn't work for her, tried drug two, didn't work for her. Now drug three worked for her. So she can go tell her coworkers and family and so on. Yeah, drug three works for me. How reliable is that kind of reasoning? My kind of a priori view, and one that that looks like is being borne out in this work I'm doing with my PhD student, is that if diseases are a little bit placebo responsive, or if they have a kind of natural course of improvement, like the common cold getting better in a week, then that kind of reasoning isn't very reliable. But if, on the other hand, diseases don't have much placebo or much natural course of disease, and you do see this kind of improvement in the clinic, then your inference that it was the intervention that caused the improvement can be pretty reliable. But as a matter of fact, we know that many diseases have this natural course of improvement, and many diseases are placebo responsive. So that pattern of reasoning for many kinds of diseases is unreliable.
It kind of goes back to your idea of the medical bullet solutions that are very good, and they're very limited, and yeah. And our whole idea of everything else is, you know, a medical bullet in a sense.
Yeah, magic bullet. Yeah,
so. Yeah, magic bullet. I'm sorry, magic bullet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. So you know, if you've got a patient with this particular bacterial infection, you might want to like get the exact details on what kind of bacterium it is. That'll guide your choice of antibiotic. But in typical cases, you know that you're going to be able to get rid of that bacterial infection. It's going to be
sure. Yeah. Otherwise, you wouldn't have people in underserved countries running around with the same infection, right? Yeah. It's very interesting that the more medical access people have, they consume more medicine. And this very simple line of logic, they would therefore then, if medicine were effective, then they would live longer and they'd live healthier. And you just don't even find that at all. And somehow people lose this thought, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, one interesting kind of empirical work that I think there should be much more of is evaluations of so-called drug discontinuation programs. So a drug discontinuation program, you can be formalized. So basically, you've got a patient or a set of patients, and you want to get them off as many of the pharmaceuticals that they're on in the most careful way possible. So not in this kind of irresponsible way, like just take them off all sure. of their drugs at one go, but take them off in a way which like follows guidelines, and you get them down to the kind of the minimum number that they can that they can get by on. There's been a few empirical evaluations of these kinds of drug discontinuation programs, and it looks like patients end up doing better. So so you get them off as many as you can, and then their outcomes are better than they were going into the trial. Now there's a few of these kinds of studies, but there's not that many of them. So I think it would be great for us to know like more about what it's like to take patients off drugs, because we sure. have a mountain of evidence for what it's like to put patients on drugs.
Yeah. And that goes back to what you were talking about with the incentives to put patients on, but who's paying to take patients off? I mean, there's really no incentive for that. Yeah. So before we wrap up, I do want to talk about one thing that we mentioned earlier, and I think it's really fascinating. We talked about rituals and the ritual of medicine. You go in and they check your height and weight, and there's this whole, I mean, almost like a religious ceremony in a sense. Do you think that the way that modern medicine is built is driven by the actors in this ritual, being the pharmaceutical companies, the physicians, the nurses, whoever it may be? Or do you think that that ritual was built around kind of social expectations, where there was people just tended to like this, and we tried lots of different things, and then we found that the system that we ended up with was just because that's what people wanted?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a complicated question, and I suppose my response, my first simplistic response would be that probably the way you frame the question is a false dichotomy, right? So it could be both of those.
Sure.
Medicine's an old institution. It's been around, you know, at least 2,000 years, and some of those rituals have been with us a long time. And then medicine has undergone various institutional changes. Medical education has undergone various institutional changes. The idea of this modern pharmaceutical company has, you know, shifted over time. And so I suppose that the patient perspective may be one which is a kind of universal, that desire for hope, that wish to go through that ritual, to be treated, to be cured, that seems like that's something that's pretty fundamental. And then the institutional structures that have grown up in medicine to be on the sort of the other side of the ritual, there's been one form or another of that for 2,000 years, but the particular shape that it's taken has, of course, changed a lot over time. But I would say that both parties to that ritual, the patient and then all the institutions and professionals and scientists and executives. And now we have, you know, multinational stock investors and so on. So there's all sorts of parties at play here, and all parties at play have particular vested interests. And those look like, I mean, one thing that's kind of interesting and troubling is that some of those interests are just so deeply entrenched in our society that it's a bit hard to see how one could kind of unpack them, right?
Yeah. So, how could we change the current paradigm?
Yeah. So some of the things that we've been speaking about during this conversation about, like, whether or not there should be intellectual property protection for medicine and so on, those, in some sense, those are kind of pie in the sky ideas, right? Because
it's not going to happen.
Yeah. There's this, some of the social forces that we're speaking about here are just so deeply entrenched. Yeah.
We're kind of stuck with it, but does that give you hope that, that we can actually somehow affect some change?
I do hope so. I mean, part of my motivation for writing that 2018 book was, I mean, you know, it's got a kind of dour title, Medical Nihilism, but
sure.
I mean, the message at the end, this chapter, Gentle Medicine at the end, I mean, I do try to suggest that, right, once we have the problems laid out in front of us, then we can try to do something about them. So it doesn't necessarily have to be kind of radical overthrow of the system, but there can be some fine tuning. We can pay, you know, better attention to high quality evidence. We can aim for more reliable evidence. We can try to mitigate the financial conflicts of interests. So I do have some hope that there are ways to improve medicine.
And considering that you are in the UK right now, do you think that a medical system run by a government entity, you know, with budgets and constraints with how much money it can spend, is better geared to do that? Because they'll look at it and say, look, I'm not spending money on this, it doesn't work. Whereas other groups, you know, a private industry, like in the US, it's much harder to do that.
Yeah. So I don't have a very clear view of this. So, you know, I'm from Canada. I've lived in the United States and I've lived in the United Kingdom. So I've seen three, you know, different healthcare systems, and they all have their problems. So Canadians like to complain about the American system because the American system has all these kind of inequities built into it. When I was in the United States, I loved the healthcare that I received because I had a very good insurance program you know, offered by my employer. And in the United Kingdom, it's a kind of standing joke that you can't really get treatment here because you got to wait for, you know, so long. But then, I mean, this is the specific part of your question was, well, given some of the skeptical worries that we have about some treatment modalities, are there differences in the systems with respect to willingness to pay for those treatment modalities? That's something that just continues to surprise me. Is basically my short answer is no, regardless of what system we're in. So I would think that, like, for example, in the American context, that there is a financial incentive for insurance companies to not fund relatively ineffective treatments. So I would think that they would have their own kind of team of evidence assessment experts that weren't just taking the results of randomized trials at face value, but were rather doing something that I kind of do in my book, namely do a deep dive into the source of the evidence and the biases in the evidence and so on. But I don't see this happening. Very rarely do insurance companies say, right, we're not paying for that treatment modality anymore. And same in Canada and same in the United Kingdom. So in the United Kingdom, we have this group of experts which is sort of doing cost-benefit analyses. So if we introduce this treatment, how many quality-adjusted life years will we gain per pound spent, per dollar spent, right? And if we get it above a certain threshold, then we'll pay for the treatment. But that group too just takes the published evidence as kind of literal gospel, without doing a kind of deep dive into all the stuff that we've been talking about. So I would think that there would be a strong interest, both on the part of a centralized government payer and on the part of a profit-motivated insurance payer.
It's just not there yet.
I just don't see it. Yeah.
I don't see it. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. Thank you so much for talking about this stuff. Is there anything you want to talk about before you go? Or
I know it's been it's been a very interesting conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. So that was Jacob Sengenga, author of Medical Nihilism, Gentle Medicine. Really interesting stuff. Thank you so much. It's fascinating stuff. So I hope people start kind of moving in this direction because I think you have some really, really good ideas.
Thanks a lot.
All right. You take care. Bye.